It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll look at the history of wild rivers in Wisconsin and why tomorrow is a major environmental milestone for the state.
First, Representative Dale Coinga, the vice chairman of the state's Budget Writing Committee, is looking to put an end to Wisconsin's alternative minimum tax.
The alternative minimum tax is charged to filers with large amounts of deductions or exclusions. It's aimed at making sure they pay a minimum amount of income tax. It largely applies to people making between $200,000 and $500,000 a year. In fact, more than 20,000 of the close to 28,000 people who pay the tax make that much money, according to the Fiscal Bureau.
Democrats have characterized the move as a proposed tax cut for the rich, but Republicans argue it would simplify the tax code and help the middle class. Here to talk about that proposal is Representative Dale Coinga from Brookfield. Representative Coinga, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So why are you proposing that Wisconsin get rid of the state's alternative minimum tax?
Yeah, so we're discussing a larger, broader tax reform move, and so this is part of it, but the whole package would be tax neutral, meaning it's not going to cost the state anything. It will be revenue neutral in this budget. So one of the things that actually got the most attention was the idea of eliminating Wisconsin's alternative minimum tax. Wisconsin is one of six states with this tax. I call it the politicians don't know what they've created, so they created a second income tax code, and essentially, in the tax code, what we've done, or what politicians have done, is created incentives because they thought certain things were good. So, for example, if you're a retired school teacher, that money is not taxed. Also, we say if you are donating money to charity, that money is not taxed. But then they have this second income tax code that jumps in, the alternative minimum tax. So, essentially, if you let's say made $150,000, or let's say you made $250,000, and you said, I'm going to give $250,000 away to charity this year, even though you gave every single dollar amount that you made, you gave it away, the state would still say, well, you still owe tax, even though we thought that was a good thing that you donated that money to charity, we're still going to tax you with this alternative minimum tax. And so just really want to simplify the tax code, be like the other 44 states that do not have an alternative minimum tax code, and that's one of the parts of the package.
Now, it sounds like getting rid of this tax would cost something like $26 million, and the tax break would go mostly to people making between $200,000 and $500,000. So given that, how do you make the case that this is the right time to do this when we have a projected budget shortfall, looking at cuts to education, looking at cuts to the university system, to the DNR? Why go after this now?
Well, there's no cuts to education. There's no cuts to K-12 in this budget. We actually reversed the governor's cuts to K-12, and then we actually put more money into K-12. You are right, there's cuts to the university. This is a revenue-neutral package. So we looked at, Senator Howard Markley and I looked at the details of the tax code, and there's a lot of stuff out there that's simply not fair. So, for example, a place where we'd pick up revenue is if someone in Chicago is booking a hotel room through Orbitz in Milwaukee, and they're paying Orbitz $100, but Orbitz is only paying $70 to Marriott, they're just collecting sales tax on that $70 from that Illinois resident, not the $100. But if they were going directly to Marriott, it would be $100. So that's just a fairness issue, which picks up revenue for the state. And when we get that revenue, we're using that for tax relief. Now, other parts of the package, like reduction of the marriage penalty, that would affect everyone for that part of it. That affects everyone under $150,000, and nearly all of it is for people under $100,000. Other parts of the package would say if you're a teacher and you are expending money in your class on supplies, we will let you take that as a tax deduction on your tax return if you are buying supplies for your classroom. That shouldn't be out of your own pocket alone. We should help pay for that. So that would be a tax deduction. So the debate over this has really been about the AMT. I think that's been because the Democrats find that this is a great way to say, oh, Republicans are cutting the university and that they're getting rid of this AMT. But the whole package is revenue neutral, and we're doing some other things in there that I think are really attractive to folks, like reducing the marriage penalty and allowing teachers to deduct supplies and other expenses they have in their classroom.
It sounds as though teachers aren't probably the ones who would mostly benefit from this, though. It's people who'd make between $200,000 and $500,000. How much of that $26 million tax cut will go to middle-income people?
Well, it depends on how you define middle income. But if you look at the Wisconsin alternative like what you're taxed on, your Wisconsin adjusted gross income. For example, there are 2,800 people in Wisconsin that have adjusted gross income of under $5,000. So under $5,000 in Wisconsin adjusted gross income, 2,800 of those people are getting a tax of $674 in addition to what they have to pay on the regular tax code. So I wouldn't say that that's necessarily the wealthy spot to be in. And once again, it's a tax on your income in a given year, not necessarily a tax on the wealthy. It depends on where you're at with your income in a given year. So, you know, essentially, if we want more money for schools, which we do, and if you want more money for further pro-growth policies, you've got to have a pro-growth tax code. And Wisconsin does not have a pro-growth tax code. We have a very, very complicated tax code that has been very detrimental to growth in Wisconsin for over a decade. And so by making the tax code less complicated, you're making it more advantageous to growth. And if we have growth, we'll have more money for schools and other priorities that we have out there.
We're talking right now with Representative Dale Cuenca from Brookfield. He's recently proposed repealing Wisconsin's alternative minimum tax. And in general, if this is revenue neutral and you're looking at raising taxes on hotel rooms, simplifying the tax code, and seeing this in general as a place to raise $26 million, why not raise that money, leave this tax in place, and put that new revenue towards roads, maybe?
Well, the transportation fund is separate. We're trying to do more and more where the transportation fund is funded with transportation revenue. So, you know, I'm for one think that the if you're going to raise some revenue in the transportation, that's okay, because I'm okay with using a fee to charge people for what they're using. And so within the context of the transportation fund, I think you're correct. I think it is time to have a conversation to see what we need to do to balance out that fund. In addition, I think we got to look at expenses. So we're looking at expenses and looking at possible revenue. We have a professional disagreement with the governor on some of those issues within the transportation fund, so we're looking to solve that problem as well.
Now, given that this would cost the state about $26 million, do we know that that number would stay the same in years to come, or is it possible it could change, maybe go up?
Well, all numbers go up. That's what, like with this budget. So let's go back 2 years ago. 2 years ago, we had a tax cut. It was about $500 million. And the criticism from the left was that you are going to reduce revenue going forward, revenue that we could use for other items. Well, if you look at this budget, we actually have $1 billion more in revenue. We actually cut taxes, but we got an increase in revenue that exceeded inflation. So the problem we have is when you're pointing out that, like, oh, these taxes could go have a higher fiscal note or lower fiscal note. I mean, the problem we have as far as not having enough money to fund everything to the extent that we'd like to fund it, like the university, is because Medicaid spending is up significantly. Medicaid spending is up $700 million in the general fund. It's up $1 billion across the whole spectrum. So, you know, I'm a believer that if you have, and I think there's evidence out there to show this, that if you have a good tax code will drive economic growth, and economic growth will create more tax revenues. And if we have more tax revenues in the next budget, then we'll have more money for our priorities.
But do you see this as being the right time to pursue this right now? There's a lot of division over the budget right now. Some of the items you mentioned, the university, roads. Why pursue this at this particular juncture when Wisconsin is already has a fair amount of economic anxiety?
Well, I mean, that's exactly why we think it's the time to do it. I mean, if you want to have further economic growth, then you got to have a better tax code. So, I mean, the problem is married people. Let's take married people, for example. Like, should you be penalized? Should you pay more taxes because you're married? And so that's like another part of the package. We're saying that's unfair. That does not make sense to tax people more because they decided to be in marriage. We said, you know what, it makes no sense to tax teachers if they're going to put that money back in the classroom. We should give them a tax deduction for that, just like the federal government. And so just because we have challenges in other areas, you're saying, oh, but you did this over there in this part of the budget. I mean, if you're doing a revenue neutral, this is revenue neutral, so it's not costing the state anything. It's net $0. Then, in fact, the way we have drafted right now, just because we haven't balanced it out yet, actually has a little bit of a revenue pickup. If it's net neutral and you're going in a direction where you have a tax code that's less complicated, I think people understand that and they think that's the right answer.
Now, you proposed this 2 years ago, but it didn't take off then. What do you think is different this time around?
Well, there's a lot of ideas in legislature that get proposed more than once, and last time I didn't have all my colleagues on the same page, and this time I'm going to try again. I talk to my colleagues and show them where it's paid for and how we're doing it. Last time, the entire tax cut was a tax cut. This is not a tax cut package. It's a tax reform package, which is always more difficult when you're doing a flat line as opposed to a tax cut. But I think the conversation is a little bit different because we've shown ways to pay for this.
Representative Coinga, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Jeremy. Appreciate it.
That was Representative Dale Coinga from Brookfield. He's proposed repealing Wisconsin's alternative minimum tax. You can continue the conversation about this over on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
A major environmental milestone takes place tomorrow in Wisconsin. June 13th is the 50th anniversary of the Wisconsin state legislature creating the Wild Rivers Act.
The act designated wild rivers in Wisconsin, creating protections for some of the state's most scenic waterways. Part of the law itself reads, "It is in the interest of this state to preserve some rivers in a free-flowing condition and to protect them from development."
Joining us now to talk more about the Wild Rivers Act is Mark Peterson. He's the executive director of the Sigurd Olson Environmental Institute at Northland College in Ashland. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Good afternoon.
So what specific protections does a waterway get if it's designated a wild river under this act?
Well, in protecting our rivers, we need to think that there are really two parts. First of all, there's the river itself. So what this law will do, or what it does, is it allows for the free-flowing condition of the river. No dams or artificial structures that might impede flow would be allowed. The impact of utility corridors must be minimized. There could be no new piers or docks put on the river, and that sort of thing. And then the other part of river protection has to do with the shoreline. So we think in terms of how do we protect the shoreline, and leaving vegetation alone within 150 feet of the bank is required of state-owned lands that go through, that the river flows through. They have to provide walk-in access only, no motorized vehicles, no maintained trails, that kind of thing along the stream bank. So the law really addresses both parts to river protection.
And what rivers are protected under this act?
There are five now. There were three that were originally put in the act in 1965, the Pike River in Marinette County, the Pine and Popple Rivers in Florence and Forest counties. And then more recently, we almost lost 40 years, but we jump ahead to about 2009. And then more recently, the Totogatick River in Bayfield, Burnett, and Washburn counties. And then a stretch of the Brunswiler River in southern Ashland County. So there are five now altogether in the state of Wisconsin.
Now, a lot of times on conservation and environmental regulation, you hear Wisconsin did something and then everybody else did it. Is this a case 50 years ago where Wisconsin was ahead of the curve, a trailblazer?
Well, this is a classic case of Wisconsin being a leader in the nation, and you could even argue perhaps even in the world when it comes to river protection, because in 1965, when Republican Representative David Martin introduced this into the assembly, which was a democratically controlled assembly, it passed unanimously both the assembly and then the Republican Senate, and Governor Warren Knowles signed the bill very quickly. It made us, Wisconsin, the first state in the nation to have a wild and scenic rivers law. And since then, in 1973, 8 years later, Minnesota passed a similar program, and they have about a half a dozen rivers and river stretches in their state. And then Oregon and Washington states also have something similar to protecting rivers. But then 3 years after we passed our act in Wisconsin, there was federal legislation proposed in 1968. Gaylord Nelson was involved in that. Walter Mondale also was a co-sponsor. And then that passed, and some speculate that the Wisconsin legislation was either an inspiration for that federal legislation, but also perhaps served parts of it as a template for what was to come from the federal government.
So what do residents of Wisconsin gain from having these wild rivers and the protections they get in our state?
Well, I think we need to think of wild rivers as perhaps an endangered resource, but a natural resource just like timber, just like clean air, just like wildlife. In this case, we've lost most of our streams from a wild state as they've been developed or changed or used for hydro dams or other industrial uses. And so what we've gained really is to hold on to some of this remnant of our heritage going back over 100 years ago when there were many more of these wild streams in Wisconsin that really kind of helped build the state from those early log drives in the early 1900s. But I think today the values that they give us would be things like certainly the natural and scenic values. As I mentioned, some of the history of these rivers in shaping our state, so their historical and cultural values. And, of course, more and more today we find recreational values on these rivers, people being able to get out and enjoy them and have a different experience than most other parts of the state. And really, to those values, I'd also add, in the way of tourism, economic values. I think Marinette and Florence County particularly have promoted their wild rivers to the benefit of the counties. In fact, in Florence now, there's a Wild River Interpretive Center, which will be the site of the celebration tomorrow of the Wild Rivers Act. And they have, I think, established something like 15 new signs around a 100-mile loop of these wild rivers that point out to the people as they approach these rivers that these are wild river rivers in Wisconsin. And so they're using it really to create kind of a special experience for the visitors to their county.
Talking to Mark Peterson about Wisconsin's Wild Rivers tomorrow, the 50th anniversary of the state's Wild Rivers Act, having special protections for originally three. Now it sounds like five waterways here in the state. Mark, scientific value, are these wild rivers useful to researchers as a comparison maybe to the non-wild rivers?
Well, I think certainly they are in that they've really kept intact these ecosystems that have been largely altered. For the most part, along these wild rivers, we don't, for example, have the extent of invasive species that have cropped in and changed the ecosystem. And most of the component parts of these ecosystems are still to be found there. So, in a sense, they're almost a relic of sorts, a little bit of a time machine that allows us to go back over 100 years ago and largely experience and see what was there before there were a great number of alterations made. So they're great laboratories for understanding both the flora and the fauna of these special systems. And because the rivers themselves protect different ecosystems in the state, we have, you know, marshes, we have dense woodland, we have different kinds of riparian areas that protect these rivers, they really provide us with a smorgasbord of different ecosystems that are being preserved for study for a better understanding of these wild resources.
Mark, the protections you mentioned are in the water, on the shoreline, but I know some threats can come from further away. Are there challenges to keeping up these rivers and maintaining their state, given you mentioned invasive species, maybe pollutants that come from a greater distance?
Well, certainly, as with any natural resource in today's world, we find more and more we're interconnected both throughout the state but with other states and, in fact, globally. You know, here on Lake Superior, one of the greatest sources of toxic pollution is airborne sources coming from as far away as Asia. So there's no way to put a kind of a glass jar around these special places. But to the degree that we have the means through law to recognize special values in the state and then develop prescriptions that these places can be largely preserved within, you know, reasonable means, I think we're well served to think about that and move on protection in those ways.
Has there ever been talk of adding still more waterways to the Wild Rivers Act?
Well, they are. The interesting thing about the Wild Rivers Act, it's largely been, with the exception of the first three rivers, it's really largely been a citizen-driven process. And so as local citizens see the value in protecting some of these wild segments of our rivers and wild streams, they can propose that to their legislator, and it can work through the system for establishment. I know one of the areas that there's been some talk about is that most of the St. Croix River, for example, is preserved in this case mostly under federal ownership with the National Park Service. But perhaps one of the most historic segments of the St. Croix River, the first 8 miles in the headwaters up near the Brule River, was a very important historical segment where voyagers would come up the Brule River from Lake Superior, and then they portage only over about 2 miles and could drop down into the St. Croix River, and from there head on all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. Those 8 miles of the upper St. Croix have no protection. It's complicated a little bit in that there's a railroad segment that goes along part of it, but perhaps that's an opportunity if local citizens wanted to get together and promote that.
Mark, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Mark Peterson, Executive Director of the Sigurd Olsen Environmental Institute at Northland College in Ashland. He joined us to talk about the 50th anniversary of the Wild Rivers Act here in Wisconsin.
I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. It's time now for Food Friday, and today we explore the delicious flavors of Persian food. We'll get to know the ingredients, the flavors, the cooking techniques that go along with dishes like Persian green beans and rice and Persian ice cream with rose water.
Layla Bruhim joins us now. She's the owner of the Madison restaurant Layla's, specializing in Persian food. Layla, thanks for coming up to the studio.
Thank you for having me.
So Persian food, maybe not a household word for a lot of people. Can you tell us, on a Persian menu or at a Persian family dinner, what kind of things are we likely to see on our plates?
You're definitely going to see some rice. That's the jewel of Iran. You're going to have some stews, perhaps some kebabs, depending on what night of the week it is. Salad, everything's going to be fresh. You're going to see a lot of green things, which are referred to as sabzi. I guess that's it. And then at the end, you'll have tea, of course.
Always tea.
Yes.
Tea's a key.
And what about sort of the key ingredients that you take a bite and you really know, oh, this is Persian food because, I don't know, there's the rose water.
the rose water. That's my nemesis.
We'll get into that.
Yeah.
But what other flavors are normally in
Persian
food? So
I think almost every dish has turmeric in it. Very few do not. The rice gets its yellow hue from saffron, so that's in a lot of dishes as well. Cardamom, onions, garlic, again, food of the earth.
Some of the basic
fragrant stuff.
Yes, very aromatic food.
Okay. And now saffron, I know it's expensive, and I've always been shy about cooking with it because I'm going to pay money for this expensive spice, and then I'm going to ruin it, whatever I do with it. Is there a key to cooking with this key ingredient?
Yes, you actually should make a tea out of it. So buy the strands and then grind them up yourself with a mortar and pestle and then brew it for a little bit and use that like a little tea water instead of just putting it in whole.
Huh. Okay, so I would have completely done it wrong. I would have wasted my saffron money.
I did too until maybe 2 years ago, so don't worry.
I bought some saffron, and I too was intimidated, and it wasn't that hard to cook with, actually. I think I used it in some rice, just a little pinch or something with some
onions.
You
don't need a lot.
Yeah, it's very strong. And I haven't done it a lot, but doesn't it sort of lend things this beautiful color too? It's not just the flavor, it's a color.
It has that great yellow, orangey, reddish color to it, so it's beautiful.
Now, can we say Persian food, if you're not familiar with it, it's like, I know it comes from the region that's now Iran, got a long history of its own, but is it in the ballpark of other cuisines?
It's somewhat similar to India. Because of where Iran and the old Persian Empire, where it was located, I think everything in that area sort of blended with each other, so typical Middle Eastern food that you would see at a generic Middle Eastern restaurant that might be run by someone who's from Lebanon or from Syria might have things on the menu that are actually Persian foods. Indian food tends to be a bit spicier, I think, than Persian food. Persian food is rarely spicy. It's very flavorful, but not hot.
Now, how did you get started cooking?
So my father is from Iran, and he moved here in the late 60s to go to school. And then we're Persian Jews, so the rest of his family came over prior to the revolution in 79. And my grandmother actually lived on the same block as us. So instead of going to daycare, we would go to her house, and that was her life. So she was a kitchen woman, and I would watch her along with The Price is Right and Young and the Restless, and then have lunch. And
what were her signature dishes that you watched her prepare over the years?
Oh, she would always, we would have Shabbat dinner at her house on Friday nights, and there was always gourma sabzi, which is, I think she used beef and lots of greens and kidney beans.
So is it a stew?
Yeah, it's a stew. And then there's another stew she would always make called fesenjoon, which is a chicken and a pomegranate walnut sauce. Of course, rice, and she had... what else would she make? She would usually do a roasted chicken, too, with lima bean and dill rice as well. So,
now, did she have all this written down in a way she could hand on to you, or was she like my Polish grandma, where you put in the right amount of this and the right amount of that, and it all comes out?
Yep. I don't think anybody has her recipes.
Not even you, when you're cooking in your restaurant? Do you get close?
I don't know. My father would probably say no.
Tough audience.
He is. But I think it's hard to please everybody, especially Persians, because they want it to taste exactly like their mother's cooking. And that's why Persian restaurants tend to fail within their first 6 months of opening, because every Iranian that comes in says, this is not gourma sabzi, this is not fesenjoon, this is not how my mother made it. And I sort of have had a hard time with Iranians having the restaurant open, that they, some of them love it and some of them hate it and think it's just totally not authentic whatsoever. So,
well, you mentioned the pomegranate, and I know that pomegranate molasses is something that I'm seeing more of lately. How do you use that flavor, the pomegranate flavor, in Persian cooking?
In stews, again. Some people are using it to make salads now, salad dressings, but for the most part, you find it in the chicken and pomegranate sauce.
And do you use the molasses, or do you use the actual little bits of fruit?
The molasses, yeah. It's easier and cheaper.
We're getting an introduction to Persian cooking and cuisine with Leyla Bruhim. She's the owner of the Madison restaurant Leyla's, which specializes in Persian food. Now, you know, Thai food has pad Thai. Your first time in a Thai restaurant is a good, safe thing to order. What, for the non-Iranians, the non-critical Iranians coming into your restaurant, what would you recommend as a starting point, a good thing to introduce them to Persian food?
I guess chicken kebab. It's kind of boring.
That's hard to go wrong.
Yeah, it's hard to screw it up, and unless I don't cook it all the way through, which then I'm poisoning you. But it's simple. Again, it's not very flavorful, but it is at the same time. So that's sort of the safest. Again, nothing is, I think, overwhelmingly going to hit you in the face.
And do you marinate the chicken?
Yes.
What do you marinate it in?
Onion juice and saffron. Mm. Sometimes turmeric, sometimes not. Depends on how I feel that day.
Well, let's get into a little of the how-to. And you pointed us toward a concept that I love, very timely, and I'll ruin the pronunciation, Koresh Rivas, a Persian stew with rhubarb in it. And I've got a monster rhubarb in my backyard that I don't know, there's no way I can use all of it. Talk us through how I might make a stew using the rhubarb for my backyard.
So every stew pretty much starts with sautéing onions, then adding meat, unless you're a vegetarian, and then you don't have to. And it'll all work out fine. I usually add beans instead or some other kind of protein just to balance everything out. Then chop up your rhubarb and throw it in.
Is there any sugar in there? My mind gets
a little tiny bit, not too much.
I always think of rhubarb with sweet things.
I know. That's why I picked this recipe to talk about, because yeah, everyone thinks of rhubarb pie, rhubarb strawberry pie, stuff like that. So, but alongside meat, it's actually really, really good.
So this is not a dessert stew.
No.
This is just a savory stew. What kind of flavor does it have? I'm trying to imagine it right now.
Kind of like a weird celery.
Huh.
A very, very sour celery.
Interesting. Yeah, because I can only eat so much. I make a lot of crisp with my rhubarb, and I like crisp, but I only want to eat so much of it any given year. So I like the idea. And it seems like, looking at the different stews in Persian cooking, it seems like for people making it at home, it would lend itself to slow cooking. Is that something that would work well with some of the stews in Persian cuisine?
Definitely. The only thing to be careful about would be making sure that you have your meat partially cooked before you put it in, otherwise it could get a little mushy.
So you kind of, you brown it first?
Yeah, and then putting it in there. But there are lots of recipes on the internet for Persian cooking for slow cookers.
And let's get back to that rose water. You said rose water was your nemesis. I have to admit, I've tried really hard to like rose water, and sometimes if it's in sort of a dessert presentation, it can be beautiful and fragrant, but when I first had it, it was a tough sell. What do you think about rose water?
I have some childhood trauma from it.
Uh-oh.
That it was sort of added to a lot of things where it shouldn't have been, and I'm still suffering from that. It would just be found in a lot of in stews and just didn't taste very good. If you don't have good quality rose water, it just sort of tastes like cheap perfume.
How is rose water made?
I don't know, actually. I assume it's an infusion.
I just wondering if you infuse actual rose petals
you could
into
do
the
it,
water.
You could do it yourself that way.
So what's
with alcohol.
What's
maybe.
The right place to use rose water, then, if you don't want it in your stew?
For me, nowhere.
Nowhere. But for the non-rose water
rose water haters, a little bit in tea. Some people will add it to their baklava. I think in sweet things it's good. Maybe a cocktail would be acceptable.
Right, it's in that Persian ice cream recipe that you sent us.
Yes.
It's got some pistachios and some rose water. What do you like about that recipe?
It's, making your own ice cream. How fun is that? And I, again, would probably add maybe a tiny drop of it to that. Just, it's very strong stuff. So whatever their recommendation is, I would definitely change that. It would just add a little bit more to it, I think.
We're talking about Persian cuisine today for Food Friday with Leyla Bruhim. She's the owner of Leyla's Restaurant, specializing in Persian food.
And we'd love to hear from you. Do you have questions about cooking Persian food? Maybe a favorite dish or an ingredient? Any saffron experiences or rose water experiences? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. For today's Food Friday, we're heading east and exploring the flavors and the techniques of Persian food. We're getting to know ingredients like rose water, pistachios, turmeric, saffron. Leyla Bruhim stays with us. She's the owner of Leyla's, a restaurant in Madison specializing in Persian food.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about Persian food, maybe an ingredient that you've cooked with or would like to try? And is this part of your food heritage? Tell us about your stories, your favorite dishes. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Leyla, there used to be a place nearby, the WPR studios, that did some of this cuisine, and they did a dish called kuku sabzi. I think I'm pronouncing it right, and it was this beautiful savory egg thing with different things folded into it. Can you tell us about that one? I think that one's sort of a staple, right?
Yes. So a kuku is sort of a cross between a souffle and a frittata. And you can have lots of different things in them. The most well-known one is the sabzi kuku. And that is, again, sabzi is sort of the meaning of greens. Hmm. So green onions, spinach, cilantro, parsley, these kinds of things, herbs, green herbs. So you just chop those up, mix them with some eggs. Well, there's a little bit more to that, but and then
any other herbs or things that go in?
It can be sort of whatever is around. That's the beauty, again, of Persian food, is that it's they sort of use what they had available, because it's old food. There wasn't a grocery store in 550 BC, so whatever was growing in the garden was sort of what was thrown in. So some people will put dill into it. Some people would put garlic chives. I actually was thinking of the word in Farsi for once, for what that was. And yeah, you can, whatever you don't like, leave out. Whatever you do like, put in. And it's, they take about 5 minutes to make. Some, if you want to bake it in your oven, you could do that instead. It would take longer. You can stabilize the souffle component, or you can, you know, prepare it gluten-free without putting any flour in, and then it sort of, that's how I prepare it at the restaurant, and so I get to see it look really pretty and puffy, and then by the time it gets out to the customer, it's like a flat pancake.
And what do you serve it with? Like, as a sandwich or with sides?
I usually serve it with bread. You can make a sandwich out of it. I kind of leave that up to people, how they want to do it.
Yeah, that's one of the foods I've probably eaten the most back when the restaurant was there without actually knowing what I was eating. I would have guessed egg, and that's about as far as I got, but it was really good. And that's one of the staples, you say.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and you can have it every day at my restaurant.
Are there cooking methods that are particular to Persian food? I'm thinking sometimes I've had the rice that seems to get really crispy on the bottom.
Yes, that's called tahdik. So to make Persian rice, you parboil rice, sort of like how you make pasta, and then you would drain it, and then you put it back in the pot. And on the bottom, you can put different things like bread or potatoes or meat sometimes, and then that sort of forms a golden crust called the tahdik, and that's actually the tell of if you are a good cook or not.
Oh, really?
In Persian.
Wait, so should it be extra crispy and golden? Is that how you know?
Yes. So I'm a medium cook, so the middle of mine is usually burned, and then the outsides are golden.
We'll go to a caller now. We've got Jeffrey on the line in Escanaba, Michigan. Jeffrey, hi.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody.
Oh, what'd you want to bring up, Jeffrey?
Well, Layla, you know, I have a question. When I was a child growing up, my mother was always interested in doing unique things in the kitchen and trying to create fun dishes for the kids and stuff like that, and there was one in particular I recall. It was entitled boba tea, and now I'm not sure if that's something you've heard of or ever cooked or know of it from your childhood. But it was something that came from the Persian area, and I believe. And I was just curious if you knew what it is.
Boba tea. Does that ring a bell?
Boba tea or boba chi?
Boba chi, maybe.
Boba chi. Yes.
Boba chi.
I don't think so.
Jeffrey, describe it to us, if you would. What was it like, or what was in it?
Well, you know, you'll have to forgive me. I don't remember the exact ingredients. I was, I don't know, 11 or 12, okay. But the experience I had was amusing. My mother made it. She was all excited, and she presented it to the kids, and we all tried it, and my mother smiled and gently placed her fork down and excused herself from the table, and I think she was actually laughing in the kitchen because she knew it wasn't very good. And I tried to give some to the dog, and the dog wouldn't even eat it, so I just thought it was really funny, and I was wondering if Layla had heard of it, because if she could, I could remind myself what it was made of. But
Jeffrey, thanks a lot for the call. I'm not sure that he really wants to recreate that. Okay. I mean, growing up with Persian food, did you ever have, apart from the overuse, as you saw it, of rose water, were there ever Persian dishes from your family, Layla, that just, nobody went for them?
No, I don't think so. We always, we liked our food.
Yeah. That can come of trying to get that mystery food from another culture. I've definitely made some horrible curries in my life back before I knew what I was doing. That I wouldn't try to feed
curries
any other human.
Curries can be complicated. Yeah. Definitely. You've got to pass on that one. Well, my sense also with Persian cuisine is that yogurt looms really large,
yes.
That you can put it on a lot of things, almost everything. Mm-hmm. What do you recommend for a good basic yogurt side dish?
Yogurt, cucumbers, dill, little sour cream, salt, pepper, the end.
Sounds pretty simple. Do you have to do anything like DC the cucumber? Can you just let it rip, put it all in there?
I don't use English cucumbers in anything. I don't like the way that they taste, so I get the seedless ones that are smooth. There's some lovely farmers at our farmer's market that have now started growing them. I really like the small ones that, you know, Trader Joe's has dubbed the Persian cucumber. So you can grab those. They're the little tiny ones that are smooth on the outside and they don't have as many bumps. Leave it sit for a couple hours, The longer things go, I think the better they taste, within reason.
Uh-huh. So what is it about the yogurt that you think goes so well with so much of what you're making?
So Persian foods have the idea of hot and cold behind them, so you want to balance everything. So, you know, if you have a hot stew, putting cold yogurt on it is balancing it. But it's more than that, too. It's the hot and cold does not necessarily refer to the temperature. It's also, like, green herbs are seen as cold, whereas meat is a hot. But, you know, it all balances inside of your body.
And you mentioned meat optional in some recipes. Veggies to substitute in some texture in case of the absence of meat. I think of eggplant. Is that a common thing in Persian cooking?
Yep. The badam jan is what it's called in Farsi, and you find it in tons of things. It's like the potato of Iran, I guess.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The eggplant is the potato of Iran.
I don't know. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. I think you've just created a soundbite that could go viral.
Is it something that'll be mixed into the stew, or will it be a side dish on its own, or maybe both, I'm guessing?
There are stews that are just based on that. So it's called Khoresh Badam Jan, and you can add chicken, or you can leave the chicken out.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah, so a lot of great ideas here. Looking forward to trying some of these things at home. Layla, thanks so much for coming up to the studio today.
Thank you guys for having me.
That was Layla Bruhim, the owner of Layla's Restaurant in Madison, specializing in Persian food. We've got one recipe linked on the Central Time Facebook page so far, right?
Right. This is one recipe that Layla found and you enjoyed, and it's for Persian ice cream. It's got a bit of rose water. Warning you about that.
You can leave it out
delicious,
if you
and
want.
Also pistachios. Mm-hmm. Perfect summer fare there. And it's up on the Central Time Facebook page.
Two legendary performers passed away this week. Actor Christopher Lee at age 93 and saxophonist and jazz pioneer Ornette Coleman at 85.
Christopher Lee was usually the menacing bad guy from Dracula to the Star Wars prequels. Hard to pick really just one performance of his, but here he is as Saruman in Lord of the Rings, sending his army of orcs off to war.
This night, to Helm's Deep, leave none alive. To war!
Menacing. He's one of those guys where if he's in a movie, even a bad movie, it's going to be a little better because he was there.
Right, and that voice.
Right.
That incredible voice of his. Wow.
And now Ornette Coleman, speaking of great voices, a very distinct voice on the saxophone. I'm a saxophonist of a much, much, much lower degree of skill. Lucky enough to see him play back in the late 80s in Ann Arbor. And I could only say, what? To a lot of what he did. It was just amazing. He reinvented the genre.
You just gotta let it roll over you.
In some ways, yeah, definitely. Well, we're going out to the news with one of my favorite movie soundtracks of all time, Ornette Coleman with Howard Shore on the Naked Lunch soundtrack. Like the music better than the movie, actually. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.